The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Saturday afternoon with me, Carolyn Yeager. It's October 20th, 2012. Though I tried to have someone on with me today, and in fact, I tried to get a panel discussion arranged, but nothing worked out. It's very time consuming trying to get people together on the same playing field. But I will have a guest on Monday's Heretics Hour, Arthur Topham of the Radical Press in Canada, telling us about his latest ordeal with the Jewish power structure there. Excuse me. He has been through the ringer, and is just now able to be speaking about it. So all these reasons are why you are getting a full dose of me today, and I'm shifting my continuing topic of sexual deviance to this Saturday program that I would have done on Monday, because Arthur couldn't come on today and will be coming on Monday. I want to mention that my email is I'm into my email box, and you are invited to email me about this program as you listen to it, which is at Carolyn@CarolynYeager.com if you want to make a comment or a question. I will try to keep checking that, although I've got an awful lot of stuff that I'm prepared to say today. And it's easy for me to forget, but I will definitely not forget during the 5-minute break between first hour and second hour. And I also want to mention donations today. In order for the White Network to expand and to continue to bring what we are bringing and to continue to operate, our expenses are going up, and my personal expenses are going up also. So all of that causes me to bring up the topic of donations. And really, the donations at the White Network have kind of stopped. I don't know when the last time we got one that was actually sent to the White Network. Well, it was in the last month we got some, but we haven't had anything for quite a while. So I do encourage, and I think I do need to mention it. I do encourage those of you who are regular listeners and enjoy the programs, what we have on our website, think about making a monthly or bi-monthly contribution. It doesn't have to be a lot, but something that would help us to offset our costs. Because there are many things we'd like to do, but of course, it's not only financial donations, but contributions, and contributions in the way of doing programs. We would like to find some more program hosts, and if we had some more hosts, we could set up a Friday show. We would like to set up a Friday show, but as it is now, people have commitments that they cannot commit to, and I can't run it because I have a Thursday show and this Saturday show, and that is too much for me to take on, too much responsibility for that. I can appear on it, and I think we have a real good idea, a real good format for a Friday night program, based on a news program, a news type program, but we need someone who is really reliable to commit to being, one of the people who would be on that, because I want at least three people every Friday to be discussing, the week's news. Not two and not one, you know, who's left there by himself because other people don't show up. So, you know, the reason why I'd like to have it made up of a White Network hosts is because if you're a host on the White Network, you're more committed to it. And if you're not a host, someone might be more prone to copping out, you know, I can't do it now, I can't do it now. And, you know, people get started and then they don't feel prepared or whatever. You know, it happens, and I don't want that to happen. I don't want to start shows that aren't going to continue, particularly that Friday show. So we need some dedicated people, and that is kind of one of the problems that we tend to have in our movement, is that while we don't even have as many, I suppose, listeners and readers as we would like, we definitely don't have as many people who write and talk. If any of you are thinking about that or would like to do it or feel like, well, you know, write to me, write to Tan, talk to us, and just tell us what you have in mind, and we'll see how it goes. But it is true that you have to have something. You have to be able to really do something pretty much on your own. I mean, there's nobody going to give you lessons in how to do a program, except for the technical issues. All right. So let me get on, because I do have a lot to say, and I think it's going to be an interesting program. And last Monday's Heretics Hour was on why we tolerate so much pornography and also so much pedophilia. Well, today's program, I have a temporary title here of Pedophile Rings Go to the Top of Governments, because I want to talk about those I didn't really get around to last Monday, and that is people in top government echelons who are either engaging in pedophilia or are covering up for it. Sometimes you can't really catch them at engaging in it, but if they're covering up for it, they very likely might be also engaging in it. But this is what I'm going after today, and I just felt like to bring this full circle, and this may be bringing it full circle, today's program. I don't intend to put this on you know, program after program, but sometimes to really get into things, you have to talk about it for a while to get everything covered that needs to be covered. So I think what I'm going to say today needs to be covered. And so what I said last week about Monday about why do we tolerate it, you might think, well, it's not about choice. You know, we don't really have the choice. Well, I'd say it partly is and it partly isn't. The only real solution that I have thought about this, and the only real solution that comes to my mind is for people to stop consuming these products. And when it comes to pornography, especially, we can stop consuming it. Comes to pedophilia, that's something else again. They are not, of course, the same thing, but they are part of the same problem. They're in the same category. But with everything, with all the garbage that's put out there that the governing elites use in order to dumb us down as a people, this is one of the things that they use to do it. They use this crap, this pornography that, unfortunately, from the comments that we get, is that so many men and so many white nationalist men even appear to, they defend it, saying that it's really harmless for most people. You're born, if you're going to be a pedophile or you're going to be a serial killer or you're going to be, you know, if you're going to harm people, well, you're born that way. You don't get that way from watching pornography and so on. Well, I don't think you can say that exactly. I think there's a lot of exceptions to that. And the fact is that this does not do us any good. It does not help us to have our men sitting around getting satisfied with stuff like this instead of looking to real women and in real life, in real marriage, and taking ourselves as we are, not these showy, made up, dressed up bad actors, you know, on the screen, and watching them do things. This is like, oh, of course, you know, I think we should not be consuming their movies. They're regular, mainstream movies. I don't think we should be consuming their mainstream news except just enough to find out what they're saying and what's in the news, like I'm going to do some of this today. We need to get away from being consumers, because this is how they hook us. This is how they get to us. And we're not really able to separate all of that like many people think they can, but we can't. So there was a time when we began being referred to as consumers. You know, that's a kind of a new word coined, and at that time, probably around in the 70s, I would think, people noticed it. And we were saying things like, gee, we're only consumers now, kind of like it was a joke. You know, not so much a joke, but, you know, it was seen as bad, but it wasn't like, well, we better stop this right now. No, you know, nobody ever does that. It's just, we notice what they're doing and we say, this is not good. But, after a while we get used to it. And, we're even consumers of politics now. We don't decide what's going to happen in the political system. We are, in the sense of consumers, we get to make a selection, just like in any other products. We get to make a selection. Do we want, product A or product B? That's still being a consumer. And consumers replaced workers. The United States is really not a nation of workers anymore, but of consumers. It seems to me that finding workers around the globe to make what needs to be made is not a problem. There's plenty of workers all around the globe when you're a global community, and they're there ready to work pretty cheap. So what's left for us here to do is to buy the stuff that's being made and to consume it in order to serve what's called the economy. And now it's called the world economy, or the global economy or whatever, and we can't let it die. We can't let it collapse, because then we're all going to be in terrible trouble, and they tell us what will happen. So we have to consume to keep it going. As passive consumers, we are more easily sedated, and we are a rather sedated people now. You know, we really have to let the economic train crash happen in spite of what they tell us. And we, in order to do that, and if that happens, we have to base our lives on something different, something that we believe in, that belongs to us and benefits us, not the Jews and not the communistic, raceless one-worlders. I see that porn and the rise in tolerance of pedophilia is an attack on us. You know, it's an attack on these things that I just said, that is real in our lives, that is something that we believe in, that belongs to us. This is an attack on us, just like many other things are. And the Jews are behind it in very many guises. But it is more complicated than to just point to the Jews. And our willingness to be consumers is where we have to start in fighting this attack, because we don't have any other options. This is what, why I'm saying this, because as I look at it, And I don't like to blame white people for white people's problems when so many others have set up these problems and kind of pushed us into it. But I also know that the only way out is for us to take responsibility for what we're doing and what we have done and make changes. That's the only way out, because we cannot change the system from the weak position we're in and from the outside as we are. We can't change it, and we can't get to the inside and change it either, because you can't become an insider unless you are absolutely, unless they know you're one of them and you caved into what they're all about. So the only thing we can do is to stop consuming what they're putting out to us. And this is a huge job. I don't know how many white leaders are actually saying this very clearly. I don't think so. If there was somebody, I'd point to them. But they're saying it gets very complex. Everybody's talking about this, that, and the other thing. Wants to say something that nobody else is saying, maybe, or say something different or attract readers, attract listeners. But it's really very simple what we have to do and what we what a difference it would make. And that's the whole idea of boycott and stop buying this stuff, stop watching this stuff, stop paying for this stuff, and so on. But to continue, you know, every so often, some of this sleaze, to get back to the porn and pedophilia, which is what my program is really about here, every so often, this sleaze behind the entertainment facade or political facade or whatever breaks out, and it's not successfully covered up, and we have a new scandal. And the media is then forced to acknowledge it, and some investigations take place in order to quiet things down again. Excuse me. Let me take a drink. Right now, we have the Jimmy Savile scandal going on. I think that's the way his name is pronounced. Anyway, that's the way I'm going to pronounce it. And the BBC was forced to say that they would do a thorough investigation and a program about their failings will air on this Monday. This Monday. I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in what they come up with. I will be. The reason I'm bringing up Jimmy Savile is because I have not talked about him previously, and I didn't bring him up because I figured everybody was reading about it and knew about it, and I wanted to say some other things last week or cover a lot of material that I had last Monday. But I think now that it's important to mention him, even though he isn't the worst of, he's not a killer or he hasn't murdered anyone or, you know, he hasn't kidnapped children and put them in dungeons or anything. But as we think about his long-running time in engaging in the kind of behavior he engaged in and people knowing about it and not saying anything about it and allowing it to go on, it is a very big, big deal. And so I'm going to spend a little time talking about him right now and then go on to some other big-name people. Because the BBC, well, I'll cover that later. All right, I'll just continue with what I've got in front of me here. Now the latest is that the British police have been forced to begin a formal investigation of their own because so many people, what I read was over 200 already, have come forth with stories of Savile sexual abuse of them when they were children. But there's another reason for it, and I'll read that in a minute when I go to that article that appeared. But for now, I'll say this BBC investigation, in quotes, BBC investigation, they're investigating themselves, will not give people any options to change things. You know, as we find, because all these things have happened before, how many sex scandals have there been? And then if they really come out bad, well, somebody, the government does an investigation, the media does an investigation, whoever. And, you know, some people are, you know, thrown to the wolves and, some people are given some minor, you know, guilty charges of whatever. But the big people always are never mentioned, always get away. And it is hard because they cover the way they set these things up. It is hard to prove things against them. So they really don't give us any pathway to permanent correction. And when this stuff is over, there won't be any pathway to actually correcting the situation. It'll just be, well, we investigated, we punished the guilty parties, and we've done our job. And now we're going to, and then they say they're going to have a new time of openness and transparency. And that's always a lie because they're actually wanting to close things up even more so this doesn't happen again. Because they're not going to get at the core problems. Now, the BBC, as we know, is a globalist. We have to remember that the BBC is a globalist, Jewish-dominated, and Jewish-friendly organization, just as is all official Britain and all official United Kingdom. Even though a lot of these people that we're going to be talking about, they're not Jewish, and I'm not in this case, in the case of pedophilia and so on, I'm not going to just say, well, this is just all from the Jews. But I think pornography is basically run and staffed by Jews. And yet, the problem is that so many non-Jews make money off of it, and or make money off of something related to it, or whatever. And for whatever reasons they have, they just allow it to go on, and they don't mind it going on, and they don't mind the Jews doing it either. So this, we can't blame it all, as I already said, on the Jews. At the same time, we can't blame it all on ourselves. Now, just to, I hope I've said enough about that. Now, this Jimmy Savile has been getting away with this stuff since the 1970s. And the BBC made him into a big star and then kept him on because he was a big star. In 1910, I began writing about Dennis Avey and his fake Holocaust survivor story, which the BBC was making a big deal out of, both in print and on TV, and getting very involved in. They even had one of their reporters helping they had their whole team looking, helping to find some of the missing links that were in Dennis Avey's story to help bolster it up. And then they had one of their own journalists help Dennis Avey. He was Dennis Avey's co-author in writing his book, because Dennis was not capable of actually writing a book, but he was telling this fantastic story, which got more fantastic all the time, actually. This is something that I wrote in one of my follow-up articles in 2011, and it was, all of this is on my website, CarolynJaeger.com or CarolynJaeger.net right now. I've taken, this is a quote from one of the articles that, from 2011. Avey's co-author, Rob Broomby, a BBC journalist and rep, well, I just stuck that in it to identify him, has made excuses for the implausibilities in the story and has had to admit that he can't confirm whether the swap was a big part of Avey's story, really happened. It's very difficult to verify at this stage, Broomby said. You're not going to find people 70 years afterwards. It's only when you spend time with Dennis that you know what he's like. So they're saying, well, yeah, they can't verify it factually, but you're just supposed to trust Dennis because they play him up as such a great guy. He's over 90 years old, and he's finally coming out with his story, you know, which he only started talking about 10 years previously and never mentioned before. Now, this Dennis, I'm continuing my quoting here from my article. Dennis falls back on the same kind of defense. In 2010, 10 years ago, Avey gave a 5-hour interview to the Imperial War Museum and did not mention the swap. When recently asked why, he said, I don't know why. I didn't choose to establish it then, but what I wrote in the book is the truth. I don't have to defend it. I don't mind what anybody says. I know what I've done, unquote. The BBC is backing this guy who says he doesn't know why he said something different before and why he came up with this now, but oh, whatever. You know, he doesn't have to defend himself. He's the honorable guy. And Broomby has also said, as I'm still quoting for myself here, this is not footnoted academic history. You have to look into the man's eyes and know what sort of man this is. So, now, that's the end of what I wrote. Now, the BBC plus the Labour Party, plus the upcoming elections for Gordon Brown at that time, in the 1910 and 11, and Labour candidates, is what was behind all this. You know, it's all political. It was all political. And Brown was using the Holocaust for an electoral advantage, and he is the one who came up with the, or his political advisors, came up with the Heroes of the Holocaust Award to be given out during this, before the election took place. And it was going to be like 20 or 25, and they did do it, British people who did something wonderful to save Jews during the war. And they were going to be given this brand new honor that the government had come up with, Heroes of the Holocaust. And, you know, this, the Labor Party was in power, and so, you know what, they were the government, and so they were behind all this. And Avey was to get one of these awards. And so the whole thing was being played up quite big, and And beyond that, I learned, but at part of why I'm going through this is because at this time I learned about the pedophile Greville Janner and his association with the Labor government and with Dennis Abbey, and I'll go into that some after I talk about the latest developments in the Seville pedophile case. My purpose is to show the common nature of ignoring and allowing pedophilia to flourish, with the support for it coming from the top levels of government, even prime ministers and presidents and kings and queens. So, all that is to come, plus even more, if I can fit it all in. If I just keep going straight through and don't go on my usual little detours that I go on. This story that I'm going to, and since I don't know how well people know all the facts about the Seville case, I will read these excerpts I have from this latest article that appeared in the papers in just yesterday. This came out just yesterday. UK opens criminal inquiry into BBC star's child abuse. It's Dateline London. British police investigating alleged sexual abuse by BBC presenter Jimmy Savile launched a criminal inquiry on Friday. That's this past Friday, yesterday, saying more than 200 potential victims had come forward since accusations he had preyed on children for decades. Cigar-chomping Savile, knighted as a sir by Queen Elizabeth, was one of the BBC's biggest names, and questions have been raised about whether the broadcaster turned a blind eye to his activities. Some women said he abused them. I'm just taking parts of this article. Some women said he abused them when they were as young as 12, and sometimes on the BBC premises. London's Metropolitan Police previously said they would conduct only a review into the allegations, since Savile was dead, and only so that alleged victims could be officially acknowledged. They weren't going to investigate it as a crime. They were just going to try to do a review so that the victims could be acknowledged for that they suffered something. But the force said on Friday the review had been broadened into a criminal investigation because it had established in the last 2 weeks that there are lines of inquiry involving living people that require formal investigation. Those people were not named, and the force did not elaborate further. I think this means, maybe, that these other living people that have become part of the inquiry might be politicians, media editors, etc., or anyone who would have known about and covered up what Savile was doing. I don't think they're talking about the victims, who would be telling their story of what happened, because they already had those. But what new has come up is that there's other people being living people being implicated in it, and so there, that means, according to the way the British police work, that means they have to do it. They should do a criminal investigation. Police Commander Peter Spindler said a staggering number of potential victims had come forward to report sexual exploitation during their childhood, with more than 400 lines of inquiry being pursued. We are dealing with alleged abuse on an unprecedented scale, he said. Mark Thompson, the New York Times Company's incoming chief executive, who ran the BBC when it dropped an investigation by its own Newsnight program into Savile last year, the New York Times, this is a different article from the New York Times, has come out with this statement that Thompson said recently, and of course, remember, he has moved from the BBC to the New York Times. He's their new chief executive. And he has said recently that he had not known the Newsnight segment on Mr. Savile was in the works, so he's trying to deny that he knew anything about what was going on. And Newsnight's editor, Peter Rippon, has said that the program had been looking for evidence of institutional failings by police or prosecutors. They hadn't been looking for failings by, I don't know, by BBC, I guess. And they had not found any failings by the police or prosecutors. However, a leaked internal email published in the Times on Friday cast doubt on that explanation, saying that the Newsnight program was indeed focusing on allegations of abuse. And so Rippon and Newsnight are not being honest. Now, so now the BBC has launched two independent reviews of the allegations, one looking into unlawful conduct by Saville when he was working for the BBC, and another to investigate why the Newsnight report was shelved. So we have investigations at the BBC, and we have now the British police launching a formal criminal investigation. And here's just a comment from the New York Times in their article. They said they described Saville as familiar a presence as Johnny Carson or Dick Clark, you know, to the British, and as odd a character as Pee Wee Herman. He was knighted by the Queen. He was a friend of Prince Charles, and 4,000 people attended his funeral last year. So, you know, he was truly had been built into a national icon. All the highest of the high people in Britain were friends with him and liked him, and he was invited to all their things, including politicians and so on. And now this. And that's why, even though they were started an investigation in 2007, or they were looking into it, they just swept it under the rug and said, we will do a lot of these, you know, promo things, talking about what a great man he is, and try to overwhelm these rumors that are going around that they wanted to think were just rumors. But eventually, he was so blatant in everything that eventually it came out, which is good. But now, here's another good article by, in the Daily Mail on October 1st, which is, you know, 20 days ago. But still, they came up with some stuff, that I think needs to be said. They wrote, Sir Jimmy Saville was interviewed by police over child abuse allegations in 2007, but no charges were ever brought. So at that time, you know, they actually interviewed him. And it was about, he was questioned about an alleged indecent assault at a children's home, the now closed Duncroft Approved School for Girls near Staines, Surrey, where Saville was a regular visitor during the 1970s. But the Crown Prosecution Service decided there was insufficient evidence to proceed. And this article says that this is the first time, in this article that they wrote on October 1st, that it has been revealed that Saville was ever questioned by police over sexual assault allegations. So this goes back to 2007, and it has been covered up since, and now it is 2012, the end of 2012. And here's some, listen to this. I found this very interesting. This is probably typical of what he did, although I think he did do worse than this because he had girls in motel rooms and stuff. One is mentioned as young as 12 years old and so on. But these were a couple of, you know, he went to hospitals. He went to, he was a big part of what he did as a philanthropist and as a good, wonderful guy who loved British people and wanted to help all children. He did everything with children. He had these children's, he was on the board of a lot of children's organizations to help children. And he worked closely with these hospitals, children's hospitals, to go and visit. He was always in these hospitals visiting these kids. And he went to orphanages and schools and so on too of, underprivileged kids, and he could do whatever he wanted there because he was such a big guy and they thought he was a lover of children, and which he was, and they trusted him, and you know, they just gave him free rein. So now in this case, I'll just quote here, a girl is saying, Allison Pink. This is Allison Pink, a former patient at the Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital. She told the Sun recently that, said, I tried to squirm, but he held my wrists with his hands, and she described how Mr. Saville suddenly thrust his hands up her nightgown while she was watching television. Another woman has said, a woman named Caroline said that she had met Mr. Seville when she was a teenage spinal injury patient at Stokes Mandeville Hospital in Buckinghamshire. She says, quote, "He just bent down and rammed. That's the only way I can describe it. He just rammed his tongue right down my throat." She said she told her parents, but they did not believe her. She says, "I was a 13-year-old girl, and he was who he was, or who he was supposed to have been," she said. So she just accepted it. And, you know, I could say a lot about girls learning to accept improper advances by men, even back when I was growing up, and what I learned about it and my experiences that were not anything like this. But this is just so very true that nobody wanted to hear girls or young kids or whatever say anything about a respected adult. They didn't want to hear it. But, you know, here he is. This girl has this, she's a spinal injury patient. Here he goes to and Mandeville Hospital was one of the big ones that he raised tons and tons of money for that hospital. So that's how he convinced himself that he was doing good and that he was okay if he got paid back by taking all these liberties with these children and didn't hurt them any. You know, did it hurt this girl to have him ram his tongue down her throat? You know, into her mouth just suddenly, you know, he just bends down and does this stuff to him. You could say, some people will say, no, it didn't hurt her at all. So what? You know, I mean, but it does. It does, because that's an experience where you are being degraded and humiliated, and something is, you are being invaded, and you are young and don't know what to make of it, and it confuses you, and if you have the the strength to tell people, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to listen to you. So it does a lot of damage. So I'm not for those who say, well, unless you really, really hurt somebody, it's all just men being men. Huh. Okay. You know, the fact is that pedophiles choose professions to be around children. And I already explained how this Jimmy Seville, turned himself into a friend of children. He had his shows were about children. There were two children. He, you know, had all kinds of opportunities to be around children. And he made himself into a philanthropist for children's causes and hospitals and so on, and spent all this time there. I already said all that. So that's why he did that. But other ones do that. Too. So, pedophiles, you can learn that pedophiles cluster in professions that give them access to vulnerable children, like teaching, the clergy, and medicine. Doctors and gynecologists. I mean, pediatricians, are often, you know, I mean, I don't mean to set up a bunch of distrust of pediatricians. But that's an area where they have access to children, too. What has emerged over the last few weeks proves that Jimmy Seville was not involved in children's television by coincidence, but because it allowed him. You know, I say all this before I read my notes. So I've already said all that. You know, this Jerry Sandusky is another one who they confirmed that senior university officials had known about allegations of his abuse for a long time, but they were complicit in failing to disclose them. Well, that's another example. And even I, when I first saw this stuff about Sandusky, and I really wasn't interested in it, I didn't really want to read about it, that a coach, you know, blah. But when I finally did, I thought, I felt sorry for him. I did. My first thing was to feel sorry for Jerry Sandusky because his life, his career was being ruined, and it seemed like he was a, you know, good, nice looking white man, a good white person, and here he was. But, you know, it takes a while to break through all that kind of conditioning that we tend to have, and men have it more than women, naturally, because these are men that are being accused of all this stuff and having their lives, you know, they're the ones that are being put in prison over it. But it's only right. I mean, when you look at the whole thing and see what's been going on, And you know that these men, they determined their careers around the ability to be around children, because this, their interest in children, their sexual attraction to children probably came about real early, you know, early enough. They knew they had it. And so their whole life was a big lie. Their whole life was, you know, based on finding a way to continue their addiction. And that's what all addicts do. You know, all addicts, even if you're an alcoholic, you want to be around other alcoholics. You find you design your life so that you can spend time in bars, and alcoholics love to be around people who are drinking. They like to be in bars. And then they want other people to want to be in bars too. So, now Blair, how do we get to Tony Blair from this in Britain? You can't prove that Tony Blair himself is a pedophile, but it is a fact that Tony Blair covered up pedophilia of others. He covered up scandals, and here's the story. In 1999, an international investigation of child pornographers and pedophiles was run by Britain's National Criminal Intelligence Service, codenamed Operation OR, resulted in 7,250 suspects being identified in the United Kingdom alone. Some 1,850 people were criminally charged in the case, and there were 1,451 convictions. Now, a lot of these convictions are going to be not very much, or they're going to be, you're convicted of 2 years on probation, and you have to sign the sex registry, and you have to, do things like that, but you're not really given any hard time. Almost 500 people were interviewed under caution, meaning that they were suspects. 900 individuals remain under investigation at the time of this writing. And in early 2003, British police began to close in on some top suspects. And these included, now, you know, it started in 1999, took them till 2003, to close in on the top suspects, including senior members of Blair's government. Now, when this happened, and there are a lot of guilty parties in Blair's government at this time, 2003, remember what was going on? George Bush was pushing the war on Iraq, and that is when the war in Iraq began, I believe, and so that was in the top news, the top of the news. But at that time, Blair issued what's called in Britain a D notice, and this is a gag order on the press from publishing any details of the investigation. So Blair issued this gag order on this investigation of the top senior members of his government, basically. And he cited the impending war in Iraq as a reason for the D notice, you know, that this was, we couldn't be having all this kind of stuff going on when we had to focus on the war in Iraq and so on. Just like our security, you know, things are done for national security reasons in the United States. Police also discovered links between British Labour government pedophile suspects and the trafficking of children for purposes of prostitution from Belgium and Portugal, including young boys from an orphanage in Portugal. Now, I have got a whole list of Labour Party members who have been convicted of pedophilia. I mean, they've actually not just been charged with it or accused of it. They have been in court. All the evidence is there, and they have convictions, and most of them don't get any time. They get some kind of probation. Some of them get a little bit of time, and they get they have to sign the sex offenders registry, stuff like that. But they're all there, and I hope I have time to go through those. I'm barely going to. I'm not even going to get any more probably to my story on Greville Janner. But he was also a very top, high-level person in the in Britain and in the Labour Party, and he became a Lord after he was accused and got off from pedophilia charges, which were very well-grounded and convincing, but that was a real travesty of justice. He's a Jew. He's a Jew. Greville. Man, what is his name now? Janner, Greville Janner. But if I don't have time for him, that's the best I can do to cover him. But this, let me just say here that this Operation Orr, that was the British investigation into the high-level people in the Blair government that got gagged. In the United States, the counterpart was Operation Avalanche. However, U.S. authorities only charged 100 people out of 35,000 investigated. They only charged 100 people. The international pedophile investigation began. Now, this is good. Began when Dallas police and the U.S. Postal Inspection Service raided the offices of Landslide Productions of Fort Worth, Texas, and confiscated records on thousands of people around the world who were child pornography customers of the firm. Landslide's halcyon days as a Fort Worth-based international online marketplace of kiddie porn was during the term of Texas Governor George W. Bush. Now, you know, there's a lot of the pedophile stuff that has been uncovered under Republicans. That's absolutely true. That doesn't mean that the Democrats are not involved too, but these big ones were at this time, because it was going on elsewhere too, were under the time when the Republicans were in, and they are very culpable. In fact, George W. Bush's father was really taking advantage of a pedophile ring. But again, like with Blair and that, you can't prove it, and nobody's even going to try to prove it. I mean, the courts aren't going to. They're not going to bring down the government. You see, when it's the government, they're not going to bring down the government. No matter what party it is, they're not going to do that. So now, here's a part of this that was going on in Britain at the time. The Commons. So they found that was one thing. Okay, now this is something a little different. Tony Blair's closest confidant when he was prime minister, and probably maybe still, is a practicing pedophile. This guy, Leon. There's a fellow named Leon. I don't have his first name here. Last name is Leon, 38 years old, in Essex. He was this confidant of Tony Blair. And he used his computer, his government computer, too. Well, he used his computer to pursue his interest and perhaps curiosity into child pornography. And he searched for it on the Internet, and when he found it, he downloaded it. This was the charge against him, that he downloaded it. Now, it was said, he said that he didn't download it. But he did say to police between 2001 and 2002 that when they charged him of making an indecent image of a child, you know, this gets a little technical. He said of what he was doing, it is like a drug. You try one and you want to try something harder, and it has a snowball effect. That's what he told officers, supposedly, when he was arrested. And that rings very true. Anyway, he met members of parliament. He met the speaker and deputy speaker. And he had skills in computing and the internet for his job. That's what he needed. And so therefore he had those skills. This was the argument against him in court, because he knew what he was doing. And he said that he did not distribute material. He said, I just look at the pictures. So the fact is that, part of the law, I guess, in Britain is that you have to download the stuff. But he said that he didn't download it. He just looked at them. He had all these pictures on his computer and he just looked at them. But the courts, the prosecutor said that, that he is the man. He did download them. And the person that distributed these pictures was him. So, he got away with that. And, But more to this is that another of Blair's very close associates was Lord George Robertson. Well, he became a lord too. He wasn't always a lord. George Robertson, who was the ex-United Kingdom Defense Secretary, 1997 to 98, and the Secretary of NATO also at one time. And he has strong links with Thomas Hamilton. Thomas Hamilton is the killer, the Dunblane killer, the one who it says he's a procurer of young boys, and this Dunblane thing was a massive British establishment cover-up. Well, what happened at Dunblane was that it was a school for children. I think they were underprivileged children in Scotland. And one day a man walked in there with four or five guns and shot all the kids in the classroom and the teacher. I think it was 16 children were killed. And then he shot himself. And this man was Thomas Hamilton. And he was armed with four handguns. He opened fire, killing 16 children before turning the gun on himself. And the fact was that before that, how he got the guns was that this Lord Robertson, who was a close to Tony Blair, and let's say he was the defense secretary in 1997 and 1998, he was in the Labour Party. He is the one who helped Thomas Hamilton get his gun license, because the first time Thomas Hamilton applied to buy guns, he was turned down. But then this Robertson, who had, you know, high up the connections, and he was high up himself, he was the referee, you know, on Hamilton's next attempt to get a license. And because he was the referee, it went through. And there's never been any explanation as to why Robertson would have done that. But they would only say, I suppose, that they didn't know that Thomas Hamilton was going to do such a thing. It was supposed to be such a shock. Why did this guy kill all those people? Now, but large sections of the police report on this Dunblane massacre were banned from the public under a 100-year secrecy order. You know, so there was a campaign to lift the secrecy order, but they put all this under a 100-year secrecy order. What can be more obvious what's going on? And this was done by Lord Cullen, an establishment insider. And he also omitted and censored references to the documents in his final report. And parents and teachers were advised to concentrate their efforts on a campaign to outlaw handguns instead of focusing on how Hamilton had obtained his license, you know, had gotten the license to own six handguns. And he was already known to police to be a pedophile. And this is taking place in Scotland, and Scotland is a real, man, I mean, it's a real, hotbed of secrecy, pedophilia, and people in high office that are really rotten psychopaths. It's really, but you know, it's everywhere. But a lot of it comes out in Scotland. So it said that George Robertson had good relations with Michael Forsyth, the Scottish Secretary of State and MP for Stirling, and Forsyth congratulated and encouraged Hamilton for running a boys club previously. This Hamilton was running a boys club. Now, naturally, see, that's what pedophiles do. And he was found to have exchanged letters with Queen Elizabeth. I don't know what kind of letters they were. Maybe not real personal letters, but that's one thing that came out. And you know, the question is, are documents that are part of an investigation now state secrets to be held for 100 years, which is what's going on there, still going on. And also, why, when Thomas Hamilton's application for a gun license was turned down, did George Robertson, now Lord Robertson, and Secretary General of NATO, write him a glowing character reference and personally see to it that his application was successful. Well, there's the question that was he assigned, and was he maybe even a Manchurian candidate? But was he assigned to do that in order to stop? Because were these kids being used and being taken out of class and being used in this pedophile ring and taken to, you know, the homes of important people and misused there? Did they stage this massacre in order to keep any of them from talking? This has been 11 years ago at the time that what I'm reading was written, but the question still looms. So the fact is there was no proper autopsy and no inquest on Hamilton. They never came up with a reason as to why he did what he did. You know, doesn't make much sense to go and kill a whole classroom full of kids. And then the shotgun thing has not been answered, or the gun license. And, well, there's other questions still unanswered. So I have, I want to talk about, there's so much to talk about. I want to talk about all these, next I'm going to talk about all these pedophiles that have been charged and convicted from the, they are Labor Party, in the Labor Party, they're politically associated with the Labor Party, and also I have some from the Tory Party and the Liberal Party, so they are everywhere, but there's just many more than what I can talk about here, but we'll do that after we come back from the break, ladies and gentlemen, and enjoy the classical guitar music for the next 5 minutes, and I'll be back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry I was a little late there. I went off and let me check my time. Okay. Well, let's get going again. You know, I have a story here that I want to bring up right away that still has to do with Jimmy Savile, which was just came out today. And it's about leaked Newsnight emails, which accused the BBC of issuing misleading statements over the canceled expose. And this is going to, you know, this will come up perhaps, well, it might not be in what's going to come on Monday night, but it is the latest thing that a senior journalist who was part of the original Newsnight expose into Jimmy Savile child abuse allegations. This was that show that was supposed to be, that was set up to be run a year ago or so, and then it was shelved by the BBC, and this was when Savile was still alive. Because he didn't die all that long ago. Oh, I forget now when he died, but the allegations, the allegations warned the BBC director general nearly 2 weeks ago about a cover-up into why the report was dropped. All right, and the leaked email suggests the BBC chief George Entwistle ignored a pressing plea from investigative reporter Liz McKeon about his misleading statements regarding the content of the canceled program. He declined to speak to Ms. McKeon about the matter despite her urgent email sent 12 days ago spoken to senior BBC management about her version of events. Here's what this Liz McKeon is a TV journalist, and this other guy was the editor of the head of the Newswalk Newsnight. And in the email, the director general of programming the way this stuff is written, it's almost impossible to get the meaning out of it. She wrote in her email, "Worst of all has been what seems like a concerted effort to make it appear that our story was about something else, something that could be dropped and forgotten ahead of fulsome tribute programs. It is this which seems to be fueling the damaging claims of a cover-up." The damaging leaked email comes ahead of a panorama investigation into Jimmy Savile due on air on Monday, which is expected to look into why the BBC dropped its original Newsnight report on the TV star last year. But Mr. Entwistle has refused to be interviewed for the program, citing legal advice that he should restrict his statements to the police. Well, because he's in trouble with the police now, probably. Anyway, this is some of the latest news on this BBC investigating itself about why a year ago it was going to do this kind of an expose program about Jimmy Savile, and then it shelved it and just ran some tributes to him instead. And in my opinion, it is because they thought they would promote the they would promote the good side of Jimmy Savile and hope the other would go away, which it didn't. Now, to get back to where I left off with politics in Britain, and that is here is a list of Tory and Labour and Liberal political personages who have been convicted, and some of them jailed. And we start with Tory Party general election candidate Michael Powell, who was convicted in jail for 3 years for downloading hardcore child porn. Tory Party councillor. Now, a councillor is not an elected official is not a member of parliament. A councillor is like a party, a person with a party position, like we would have, you know, like in any locality, you have your local Republican Party and Democratic Party, and they have, well, there's more than that. It's more than that. They're elected. These people are elected. They have to stand for election to represent, to be a representative on the party council. But they're in one party or another, and they stay there. It's not like they're making laws for the government. They don't go to parliament or anything like that. So that's what a councilor is. It's kind of hard to describe real quickly. I had looked it all up, but, you know, it's probably, I have a definition somewhere in my notes. But anyway, this party councilor from Bristol named Roger Tallboys, they're all from local areas, local districts that which somebody from the party comes from. They elect someone to represent, you know, to come to these party conferences and decide how the party should operate and so on. He was convicted in jail for 6 years for multiple sex attacks on children. Party MP, this is an MP though, Tory Party MP Harvey Proctor stood trial for sex offenses of a sadomasochistic nature against teenage boys and was forced to resign. Tory Party counselor again from Stratford-on-Avon, a guy named Pilkington, was convicted of downloading hardcore child porn on his PC. He was placed on the sex offenders registry and forced to resign. Tory Party counselor from Coventry, Peter Sidworthy, charged with indecent assault of a 15-year-old boy. Now, as is mentioned, they are saying that these pedophiles and sex criminals and so on try to be elected as counselors to these parties because they have access to a lot of people, and it's kind of a cover for them, they think, something like that. But that's one of the areas that they go into. And it seems to me that there's an awful lot of politicians that do this kind of stuff, even in the United States, that often are not found out, but once in a while they're found out. And I guess politics is a place that they're attracted to, where they think they can get away with things. And they meet a lot of people anyway that way. This Pilkington is convicted of downloading hardcore child porn on his PC. Now, you know, another thing is that they go after the users more than they go after the makers and producers. And, of course, we know the makers and producers are Jews for the most part, or they're part of a huge Jewish cabal and organization, and it involves sex trafficking all around the world and all kinds of things. You don't hear much about those people. You hear about the people who are looking at it, downloading it on their PCs, and they're busy convicting these people, which that's another reason not to do it, and they shouldn't be doing. But that's like, well, if you are using stuff that's illegal, well, then, you know, they can get you on that, just like the users of drugs and so on, rather than the people who are putting the drugs out there and distributing them and so on. So there's another Tory counselor who's assaulted a 15-year-old boy. It says he was charged, but they don't have he wasn't convicted. Party mayor Chris Morgan. He's a Tory mayor of some place, and he was forced to resign after being arrested twice in 2 weeks for indecent assault on a 15-year-old girl and for suspicion of downloading child porn. So he had to resign, but after he was arrested, I don't know what happened to him. Then there was a liaison manager who was arrested for downloading porn, and a counselor, another counselor, did a whole bunch of stuff. Now we get into labor. Labor counselor Newton Aycliffe Martin Lachlan from Newton Aycliffe. He is convicted in jail for 15 years for sexually abusing three 14-year-old boys. Another labor counselor from North Lincolnshire, David Spooner, was convicted in jail for 1 year for masturbating in front of two young boys. Oh, I read about him. Some of these, I've got another page that's got all these labor people on it, and I'm familiar with that story. Labor mayor, another mayor, Nicholas Green, convicted and jailed for 10 years for 3 rapes and 13 counts of indecent assault against little girls between 6 and 10. And he raped one woman on her wedding day. Yeah, that's quite a story. I read that one too. A Labor Party activist, Mark Tan, got 15-year sentence for raping a 4-year-old girl on 2 separate occasions. And Labor Party conspired to conceal the activities of... the entire Labor Party conspired to conceal the activities of activist Mark Trotter, who was a serial child molester and who died from AIDS before he could be convicted. So he was a homosexual, too. Homosexual child molester. Labor counselor George Harding charged with indecent assault on a girl of 12. And the names of 2 Labor cabinet ministers, said to be household names, appear on the Operation OR list of subscribers to hardcore pornography. This is the same investigation which led to the arrest of rock star Pete Townsend. So who are they, Mr. Blewell? They're saying, you know, this is part of what's been, they have a gag order. They can't tell you who these people are. They can't tell the public. Now, we get to William Straw, who is the son of Labor Foreign Secretary and former Home Secretary Jack Straw. He's in the Labor government. William, his son, who was cautioned by police for drug dealing amid a frantic government attempt to cover up the matter and gag the media as to his identity. And Jack Straw also has a brother who was convicted of a sex attack on a schoolgirl. Now, homosexual mass murderer Dennis Nielsen, who strangled and dismembered 16 young men in the 1980s, was also a highly active member of Labor. Fringe groups such as the, and he was also in groups such as the Anti-Nazi League and the SWP. That's when he wasn't busy boiling people's heads in a pot or masturbating over the corpses of his victims, they say. This is Dennis Nielsen. Liberal Democrats now, there's a few Liberal Democrats here. A Liberal Democrat council candidate was convicted in jail for 2 years for sexual abuse of young boys. And one of their counselors and a mayoral candidate, Francis Butler, was prosecuted for indecent assault of a young boy. Liberal Democrat counselor from Stockport sexually assaulted a 16-year-old boy in a public toilet. He was caught. Oh, this is the one. He was caught with a plastic bag containing lubricant, plastic surgical gloves, a condom, and underpants. Liberal Democrat counselor Bill Chadwick was charged with making an indecent photograph of a child, incitement to rape, incitement to murder, incitement to kidnap, also, he had a gay lover, Alan Valentine, who was also a Liberal Democrat counselor. So now on another page, I might take a real short time to look at this Labor 25 page, which is obviously put out by the conservatives, or, you know, probably the Tories, to make the Labor look real bad. But they do look real bad. And some of the, I'm just going to mention some of the top of the list here because they're the most recent. On September 25th, this was posted this year, 1 month ago, ex-deputy Labor Party Lord Mayor John Johnson, he's ex, but was caught with hundreds of child rape images on his computer. he's still in court over it. The trial date is November 6th. Hasn't been determined yet. On September 16th, they posted a new one, another Labor Party. Well, Labor Party pedophile. They used to do a lot of propaganda in this. 3 times Labor Council candidate Richard Harris, I have to move this over, was arrested at his home, and his computer was removed for examination by child protection officers. He was arrested with a list of 500 children's names in his possession. According to neighbors, well, he was handcuffed and speeded away. Anyway, supposedly, he said to the police when interviewed, "I felt mostly turned on by children." These people try to, you know, they try to get their sentences down as low as possible and just say, well, they're sorry they attracted. They're attracted by children, but he had 500 children's names for whatever purpose. Now, in August of this year, there's this guy. This is pretty funny. This is not a white man. This is an Indian. He must be an Indian. His name is Manish Sood. He is a labor counselor in his district, and he spotted an advertisement by a schoolgirl, excuse me, for a job, and she gave her phone number in it, so to be called, and he called her and asked her for he phoned her. I guess he does things like this. He asked her for sex at a fixed price. She's just a girl. Let's see, the age is somewhere like, you know, 14 or something like that, and she got frightened, but she didn't tell anybody. And she told her school friend what this guy was asking her. And he kept sending her text messages and calling her phone. You know, these kids shouldn't have these cell phones in the first place. Then the victim got angry. And the friend got angry. Her friend got angry. And she rang this guy's phone number. He had left his phone number. And told him to leave her friend alone. Well, you know, then he started, you know, going on with her and asking her for things. He wanted to pick her up from school, told her she should bring some condoms for him, and he hoped she would wear toe rings, and, you know, junk like this, which you can't imagine that they would keep saying. But as long as these girls kept talking to him, he enjoyed saying these things to them. But they eventually went to their teacher, and the teacher listened in on one of the conversations by this guy. And so he was, charged, and the judge gave him a 3-year supervision order and banned him from being near children unsupervised. And in court, he admitted that he had a fixation for little girls, and his mother stood by him. She would also have been Indian, and saying he was a good man, he probably was to her. And that's about it. All he got was 3-year supervision out of that. Well, he didn't hurt anybody. See, if you don't hurt anybody, if you're just talking, then they can only do so much to you. But, well, I'm going to quit with that now, because I want to move on to, there's a lot of interesting stuff on that page. And actually, it's a very easy page. It's Labor 25. Darn, I just closed it off, so now I don't know what it is. But if you Google it, you'll find it. Now, I'm going to turn to the Franklin scandal. I know that the Franklin scandal is old, but it has a lot to teach us, and it is one that goes to the highest levels in the United States. And my point today is really to talk about this, the people in politics, and we will need to go up as high as we can go. And this one goes very high. And I'm actually going to read from something that was a review of a book, not the one that is most famous, the older one, but a newer book on it by someone named Bryant, I think it is. I'll come to it. But anyway, I'm just going to talk about the Franklin case in this way, because it's written so well and better than I could say it. And it's fairly brief, and it tells the whole story. And so I'll start. It's titled Men Who Hate Women, actually, the Franklin Scandal. The Franklin case broke when its namesake, the Franklin Credit Union, I need to get back to. I did check my webmail, and there was nothing there. So The Franklin case broke when its namesake, the Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, and its director, GOP high roller Lawrence E. King, otherwise known as Larry King, were investigated for massive financial fraud. King, who is a Negro, strangely, King was charged with 40 counts of embezzlement, fraud, and tax evasion. He stole a total of $40 million, to which he pled guilty. Huge, really. Amazing what this guy did. But the investigation soon turned up far more than financial crimes. King had been an information specialist in Vietnam with access to top secret communications. After the war, he cultivated relationships with friends in high places like Washington and the FBI. And he surrounded himself with a cast of characters, many of whom, like King, had been and would be accused by numerous witnesses of sexual abuse, pedophilia, child trafficking, drug crimes, and murder. The accusations made his positions on the board of directors for head, the way this is written, the accusations made his positions on the board of directors for Head Start as president of the Girls Club and executive committee member of the Campfire Girls, as well as rumors of his involvement with Nebraska's Boys Town, take on sinister connotations. And he says, shades of Mark Foley. Well, remember Mark Foley and Dennis Hastert in the House of Representatives and that whole Usher's scandal about this Mark Foley, I guess he was a congressman, sending all these, making friends with all these young, not ushers, but what were they, interns, all these young interns in Congress, and that whole scandal about 20 years ago or 30 or something, I don't know. Some of you won't even know about Dennis Hastert. Google his name, Dennis H-A-S-T-E-R-T, and find out about him, and Mark Foley. Anyway, there had long been rumors of King's homosexuality. Bryant interviewed one ex-security guard who claimed one of his duties was to give King blowjobs in his private bedroom in the basement of the credit union. And soon, witnesses started coming forward with tales of sex parties, interstate flights for the purpose of providing prepubescent children as prostitutes for pedophiles across the country, even a black market for the selling of children. A special committee was set up to investigate the allegations, but it was doomed to fail. Despite the investigators' best efforts, they were blocked at nearly every step of the way by witnesses who would turn up dead days before they were set to testify. Death threats turned witnesses, that is, meaning they caused witnesses, convinced witnesses to change their testimony or not, excuse me, or not testify or something. Incredulous officials, criminally unhelpful police, bought judges, bought lawyers, jury tampering, and a local press that seemed set on demonizing the investigation and victims and fully supporting the accused. It seemed that everyone except the general public was against them. Why that was becomes very clear when you realize who it was the victims were accusing of such crimes. Among those named in Bryant's book as involved in the pedophile ring, only those whose names were brought up in the press and trials are explicitly identified. Our local Omaha businessman and millionaire Alan Bear, Omaha Police Department Chief Robert Wadman, Omaha World Herald columnist Peter Citron, Senator Eugene Mahoney, who was a friend of the World Herald's Harold Anderson, who led the smear campaign against the Franklin investigation and investigators and witnesses. Also Judge Theodore Carlson, Congressman Barry Frank, well, we know him. He's everywhere where it comes to homosexuals and sex trafficking and so on. And CIA asset Craig Spence, who I talked about last Monday a bit, and a school systems administrator and a Department of Justice official. Now, in fact, During the course of the investigation, Peter Citron would be arrested and charged with two counts of child molestation. Police also found a large cache of child pornography in his home, and it was revealed he had a 25-year-long criminal history in different states for child molestation. Now, this Peter Citron is identified as a columnist for the World Herald Omaha newspaper. You know, I remember that Omaha is the home of, well, it's Nebraska, isn't it? Isn't it around Omaha that the that huge U.S. Air Force base for what used to be the Strategic Air Command is located, and it's still a huge Air Force base there. So it's very government around there. Very, very, how they got that there, well, they probably were a bunch of crooks who agreed to do anything and everything. So they got that big base put there in their town, and they were just in the business of protecting things for the big powers in Washington. Because as we go on, it says that, let me see where I stopped off with Peter Citron and his record, a 25-year-long criminal record. What are the chances, this guy says, of all these people being a part, you know, being accused by these kids? On a related note, George H.W. Bush would later praise the World Herald for their journalistic integrity. This is Father Bush singling out Harold Anderson, who's mentioned above as, Harold Anderson was the friend. He was another part of the World Herald, the Omaha World Herald. So this Omaha World Herald newspaper is really bad news. Well, they all are. They all are. George H.W. Bush singled out Harold Anderson especially for praise. But he praised the whole newspaper, but especially this Harold Anderson, who might have been the editor or something. In other words, the perpetrators were so placed that they had the power to squash any investigation the police department, justice department, media, and government. That is, you know, if you're, look at here, if you're the government, and then you, the media is totally with you on what you're doing, and then you have the justice department and control that, and you control the police departments, who's going to come against you? Who's going to do anything? Nobody. Nothing. There's nothing that can be done. And this is the way they are set up now. We need to realize that. We do realize it, but if we realize it too much, we might feel. This is why I say the only thing is to quit consuming their stuff. All of it. All of it. Okay, continuing. While the victims and investigators were slandered in the press, that wasn't all they had to endure, as alluded to above. Many witnesses wound up dead, as well as lead investigator Gary Caradore. Caradore, that's a very sad story about him. Caradore's is one of the most tragic stories in the whole affair. A gifted investigator known for his integrity and good skill, Caradore was indispensable in cultivating sources, tracking down witnesses, and finding the dirt. On July 10, 1990, Caradore and his son were in Chicago. Unfortunately, Caradore, having piloted his private plane there ostensibly to attend the All-Star Ball game, never should this man have been going anywhere in a private plane, but he did. Well, this was 1990. I don't know how many of these plane crashes had taken place already by then, but it says, in fact, he had other reasons than the ball game. Ball game served as a cover. He had tracked down a source with access to incriminating photographs of some of those accused. Practically all witnesses said that their interactions, sexual acts, rape, torture, were photographed and or videotaped. That's in parentheses. And Caradore had told Paul Rodriguez, who was a Washington Times reporter who had been investigating similar activities in Washington, that during the investigation, Larry King's name had repeatedly surfaced. Larry King being this black man from Omaha. Before their flight back that night, Gary had called his wife, another stupid thing, stupid. Before their flight back, Gary had called his wife to let her know that the trip had been a success. He relayed a similar message to Senator Lauren Schmidt, chairman of the Franklin Committee, saying, quote, "Lauren, we got them by the short hairs," unquote. The source had apparently been Rusty Nelson, one of the photographers who had admitted his involvement with the ring. I guess the source of this information that Gary had found and thought was so important was Rusty Nelson, a photographer who admitted his involvement with the ring and who later told Bryant that he had been Cara Dory's contact and had, in fact, provided him with photos that night in Chicago. But tragedy struck that night on the flight back, going back at night, too, when Cara Dory's plane mysteriously broke apart in air, killing him and his son. The investigation found no evidence of foul play. How good these people are, huh? Despite the fact that the plane had obviously exploded in flight, the wreckage strewn across Farmer Harold Cameron's cornfield just outside Ashton, Illinois. Well, that means that maybe they weren't so good, but the investigators who are supposed to investigate plane crashes had also been gotten to and said they couldn't find any evidence of foul play. So, missing from the recovered wreckage was Cara Dory's briefcase, which never left his side and in which he kept important documents relating to the case. With Cara Dory's death, the message to those involved in the investigation became even clearer. No one was safe, and these people would stop at nothing to cover up their crimes. Understandably, all of this was too much for many to handle, let alone accept as plausible or true. It sounded too much like fiction. It does. And it was all too easy to blame the victims while the perpetrators got off. But the evidence is clear. Multiple witnesses whose stories corroborate each other, for example, the fact that Larry King liked to be urinated on came up more than once. Overlapping investigations in different states in which the same names crop up, the involvement of previously convicted pedophiles, the friendships and partnerships among people in high places who have been implicated together by witnesses, the plane receipts, the murders, the death threats, and Bryant, the writer of this book, also received his fair share of death threats along with phone and email harassment during his investigation. And then there were the two grand jury trials. The account of these trials, especially the second, in which Alicia Owen was eventually convicted of perjury and sentenced to 9 to 15 years in jail, were perhaps the most frustrating parts of the book to read, as Alicia Owens was a young girl who was told the truth, and she's the one who they sent to prison. The FBI managed to turn two of the three victims brought to testify. They turned the two boys who failed to testify accurately when the time came. The FBI threatened them with jail or worse if they continued to tell their story. Only Alicia Owen refused to recant. The prosecution maintained that she had fabricated her story. Now, the prosecution is supposed to be, you know, they're supposed to be prosecuting the Franklin scandal thing, as far as I can understand, but instead they are prosecuting the witnesses. Anyway, they maintained that she had fabricated her story in the hopes of selling it and in order to get out of jail, because she had been serving a previous sentence. Well, none of these kids were all that innocent, unfortunately, because that had been seen too. Well, this is going to come up, so I'll wait and let it come up. But both of these reasons were absurd. First of all, as Bryant makes abundantly clear, it would have been impossible for her to coach the other two main witnesses, as it was alleged. Not once did Owen even speak to a journalist about her story, nor did she just want to get out of jail. In fact, the only way for her to avoid more jail time, which was 9 to 15 years, would have been to recant. But she had decided to tell the truth, no matter what the consequences to her person. Her lawyer was Henry Rosenthal. He was blocked, I guess, a Jewish lawyer who maybe wanted to get at all these white guys who were behind all this. That could very well be. He was blocked at every step by the Judge Raymond Joe Case, who was plucked out of retirement, especially for the case. He had previously been the judge for, as had the previous judge, Samuel Van Pelt, who had been removed, I guess, and Douglas County Deputy Attorney Gerald Moran. At times, they even tag-teamed Rosenthal, Case sustaining practically all of Moran's objections and overruling most of Rosenthal's. Rosenthal was unable to introduce evidence, ask pertinent questions to witnesses, and was generally stymied the entire trial, while Moran was free to do everything. Rosenthal wasn't, and more. In fact, the trial bordered on the criminal, like the Nuremberg trial, which devastated Rosenthal. Until that point, he had been a firm believer in the law. But this trial descended into the depths of Kafkaesque absurdity. At times, it even crossed the line of the law. I need to move along here, so I'm not going to go through all that. It just says how bad that trial was and how they, what they did to the jurors. Like before deliberations, the judge Case had made sure to let the jurors know not to watch a special TV program on the case that happened to be airing that night. And these people were going home at night, and this was a program they had not heard of until Case brought it up. It wasn't that well known. And so, of course, nearly all of them disobeyed his warning and watched the program, which was a hit job against the defense. I guess this was at a time when these testifiers were being tried themselves, because there was that. They put them on trial. This is not very clear about that. But anyway, needless to say, both trials. Yeah, here he says there's both trials. The one against the Franklin people, and then the one against the poor kids who were testifying, and now they're on trial for perjury and so on. Both trials fully exonerated the pedophiles and even punished the victims. It was a cover-up from the word go and a reprehensible perversion of justice. Well, okay, but we have that all the time. The victims, I'll just continue. But even today, the victims stick by their stories, and new ones have come forward. Bryant tracked down the original witnesses, which led to even more, including some who had been molested during their time at Boys Town, which was King's hunting ground. Their lives had been ruined. They were victims of drug addiction, trauma, and social marginalization. That's how the ring operated, after all. The victims were approached young. These were, like, say, these kids at Boys Town and other kids that they thought were vulnerable and they went after. They approached them when they were pretty young. They were then initiated into a criminal underground in incremental steps, provided with money and free drugs in return for small favors. And then things escalated to the point that they were used as child prostitutes for sadists and pedophiles. By that time, they were too far in. To talk would mean several things. First, there were the threats. Having witnessed murders firsthand, they knew such threats were not mere talk. They even involved these kids in murders. And they had them watching when they murdered people and so on. They murdered other kids even. They saw all sorts of abuse being done to other kids, and they sometimes were did it themselves. This is the kind of atmosphere and environment that they put these kids into. And as the few years went by, they had a lot of crimes against themselves. And so they didn't feel like they could go in and accuse anybody else. So they and their families would pay. Okay. They knew that these threats were not mere talk. They themselves were implicated, forced to abuse each other and recruit other victims. They recruited other kids. And third, who would believe them? As events would make clear, drug-addicted, mentally disturbed youths, often with criminal histories, do not make for credible witnesses, especially when making seemingly outlandish claims about so-called pillars of the community. King and his ilk make sure to make it so, and they know they can get away with it. But the story goes deeper. In the last chapter, Bryant writes, "In my Franklin investigation, the names of lofty politicians and power brokers who have pedophiliac appetites have repeatedly surfaced. The names have been absolutely mind-boggling. Senator Schmidt was anonymously implored not to pursue the Franklin Committee investigation because it would lead to the highest, quote, highest levels of the Republican Party," unquote. Well, we know what that would be. And shortly after, Gary Caradore realized that he was in the Fed's crosshairs and being set up for an arrest. He wrote a letter to a renowned lawyer noting that the pedophile network he uncovered extended, quote, to the highest levels of the United States, unquote. "Given the names that have surfaced in my investigation, I believe," Bryant says, "I believe that without an immaculate cover-up of Franklin, the administration of H.W. Bush may have been jeopardized." Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it would bring down, if you could ever really prove this about any of these presidents, and there's a lot of stuff about all of them, or a whole lot of them, if you could ever prove it, it would bring down their government. And why is that such a terrible thing? Well, supposedly, people are approached on the basis of patriotism. Just like I was talking about the economy earlier. Oh, if we don't continue to consume and go along with things, well, the economy will crash, and then what will happen to us? Well, we'll be out of this mess. But the same with them. Well, you can't have an administration be brought down like that. What will it do to the United States? What will it do to our standing in the world? You know, all this crap that's brought out for people to go along. Well, that administration, too bad it wasn't brought down. Too bad. And then if you're a Republican, you're really going to protect any Republican politicians because you're so identified with the party. And the same goes for Democrats. It's no different. You're going to do anything to protect the Democrats' reputation. We've got a bad guy in there now. They've all been bad. All the ones since. I can't even say when it started because there's so many bad. George Washington, maybe, back since Andrew Jackson. Anyway, now on to Craig Spence. He comes up here. Craig Spence surfaced in Paul Rodriguez's Washington Times investigation because he was over there in Washington. Spence himself, as well as other sources, claimed he was a CIA asset. Spence was involved with a call boy service run by Henry Vinson in Washington, D.C., which he used to blackmail, Vinson used to blackmail, I guess Spence too, because he was involved with it. They used to blackmail politicians and with which King was involved. Well, maybe Vinson just ran the call boy service and Spence was the one who was using it to blackmail politicians and King too. Now, you know, King ended up with $40 million and then some. Vinson, after the ingenious scheme of buying up the phone numbers of callboy escort services who had gone out of business, thus cashing in on their existing clientele, managed to end up running quite the business. But when Spence got involved, things got complicated. Spence had his place rigged. He had a big house, what's called a mansion. He had it rigged with bugging devices and cameras, which he used to film his blackmail tapes. He also introduced Vinson to Larry King. After balking at one of Spence's shady ideas and being threatened by a Justice Department official if he didn't sign on, Vinson's operation was busted, and he was eventually sentenced to 63 months in prison for various felonies on a plea bargain. Spence, although he was subpoenaed, never appeared before the grand jury. Now, see, he got away with that. In the process, the government ended up sealing his list of clientele in perpetuity. According to Vinson, that was for a reason. The list has some very recognizable names on it. So again, they're covering up for these people who could be outed for being a part of this whole sex trafficking pedophilia ring and taking children across state lines for criminal purposes and all kinds of things. So now, get a little water. Needless to say, the allegations that sprung up with Franklin start to seem a whole lot less outlandish. The same features. Well, I left out something here, but there's this book. There's a book written by a woman, Anna Salter. She's a PhD, a psychologist, and she wrote a book, Predators, Pedophiles, Rapists, and Other Sex Offenders, who they are, how they operate, and how we can protect ourselves and our children. And this reviewer here is writing about this book that he also read, I guess, and he said the same features in what she is saying appear over and over again in all these situations, as we saw in the Franklin case. So what does it all mean? He says, I think Stieg Larsson got it right. These are men who hate women and children. They lack conscience and remorse. Well, this is one person's opinion. But they lack conscience and remorse. And the other might be true. I don't know if they hate or what, but more accurately, they're psychopaths. Worst of all, they're also sadists and pedophiles. And he distinguishes among those different classes. So then he talks about this book and how it's the nation's dirty secret, domestic violence, rape, and child molestation. A lot of men will object to that because it's written by a woman and say it's, you know, feminism or something. But anyway, I will continue with this. Salter makes the important point that these offenders are not stupid. They know how to choose their victims. Just like the Franklin victims were not believed because of their histories of crime and mental illness, courts aren't likely to take the word of a four-year-old over a respected priest or public figure. The offenders interviewed by Dr. Salter had on average been charged with 1 to 3 offenses, but in private, they admitted to anywhere between 10 and 1,250 victims each. And that really does sound more likely, not 1 to 3. And they're more likely to be invited into your home than to break in. More often, they come through the front door in the daytime as friends and neighbors, as Boy Scout leaders, priests, principals, teachers, doctors, and coaches. We give them permission because we don't recognize these people as predators. And we don't recognize them because they are experts at deception. They wear a convincing mask of sanity. They live a double life. They are charming, as is one of the qualities that psychopaths are supposed to have. They are charming, well-respected, and ruthlessly cunning. But when you scratch the surface, the bare and cold, inner environment makes itself clear. One offender told Salter, who talked to a lot of these people because, you know, she interviewed a whole lot of these people, and she's a psychologist. So because people want to believe in something. See, they understand this about us. They want to hope, and they want to believe. They want to. There's something inside of people that makes them want to believe the best in things and the best in others, because the alternative is not very nice. Well, he says that's putting it mildly, and he gives here one of the cases that Salter uses of a father who was accused of abusing his 4-year-old daughter, probably by the mother or something. I don't know. That's probably where it came from. But I'm going to read this because I think it's instructive, you know, what some people think is okay and other people think is not. So see what you think of this. Convinced of his innocence, the lawyer sent this man, this father, to he was in court, you know, he was charged, sent him to a polygraph expert, hoping to be able to use the test in court. And before the test, the polygrapher tells him, I would truly hate for you to mess up your polygraph with something little that doesn't amount to a hill of beans. So if there's anything at all that you want to tell me before the polygraph, now's the time so we can get it out of the way. And, father then proceeded to tell the polygrapher how his daughter, because, you know, he was already charged with, he was going on trial for child abuse with his daughter. He told the polygrapher how his daughter grabs his penis in the shower 4 to 5 times a week, how he masturbates in the shower with her as education for her, rubs up against her at night until sometimes things happen, uses a vibrator on her until she orgasms, which she loves, he says. Well, she probably does. What does she know? You know, that's her daddy. After all that, the man failed the polygraph, but not before admitting that She, quote, has licked and sucked his penis no more than 5 times, and he has licked her vagina and performed oral sex on her not more than 10 times. This is in the book. And after that, the father complained that on account of her small body, he hurt his back while 69ing her. Now, maybe these parents were divorced. I don't know. Maybe he had custody of her, and that's when he did this stuff. None of this is explained in this article. But obviously, he had time with her, and this is what he did. And he probably told her, don't tell mommy, and so she wouldn't tell. And I'm kind of filling in the gaps here because I have to try to understand these things, how they can happen. And you know, I'm not saying, all these people are lying, this author's lying, and you know, because I'm sure this does happen, and it is with people who think that tell themselves or feel like it's okay, it doesn't hurt anything. He's not hurting her. But you know, why would he want to do it unless he's a child molester, unless he's is interested in children more than adults? From Salter's description, he says he can't help but conclude that there's a concerted effort to downplay the problem. Huh, I guess so. Salter quotes a long string of psychologists and psychiatrists, Freud being the most notorious, who have ignored, obfuscated, lied, and denied that there's even a problem. A lot of people are doing that today. Then there are organizations like the Dutch, it's a journal, a Dutch Paedica, has to do with pedophilias, whose mission, the mission of their journal is to demonstrate that pedophilia has been and remains a legitimate and productive part of the totality of human experience. And this is what those homosexuals over at Countercurrents say too. And I've got a new James O'Meara quote. I wish I could use it, but I'm not going to have time for it. So they neglect to mention that many pedophiles are also sadists. They enjoy hurting and torturing their victims too. And, here's a quote from one that I just have time for. This is a guess what you'd call a psychopath. He says, when I stuck the pistol in my victim's back, the adrenaline rush that I got out of that, well, I had done drugs before and I had drank alcohol, but nothing can compare with that rush that I got when I stuck that pistol in her back. It was like my whole world turned upside down. Everything went in slow motion for a few minutes. A lot of times I thought I was a junkie on my own adrenaline. May not have been. It may have been other chemicals in my body. But I learned how to tap into those things by using my own fear, other people's fear. And a lot of it came with the deviant behavior. That's the only way I could tap into it. I wanted that high. So here's a guy like so many others who wants this high, and the highest high he discovers is with his sadism and his, his attacks on people and so on. And in order to get that high, other people are expendable. These people don't matter. Throw them aside, you know. It doesn't matter what happens to them. It's only him and his high. This is what's so disgusting. And when people who want to get high need to think about that. How far would they go? How far could they go to keep getting their high? Now, here's another guy who said that the high from sadistic acts is different. It's more extreme. It was more extreme. It seemed to me that committing a sadistic act and having sex involved in that sadistic act just heightened everything more. The feelings and the orgasm, the ejaculation, it seemed to heighten it even more. Well, I would like to somehow get into that. Okay, you've got pillars of the community. Okay, as one group of people, you've got psychopaths, and then you've got pedophiles, and then you've got sadists. These are four are separated, and you think of them as circles, and you can intermix the circles in various ways. And she says, I guess, let me get down to this, that if you combine one and two, you get what are called corporate or political psychopaths. And if you combine two and four, you probably get a serial killer like Ted Bundy. But I mean, you know, these things can combine. And, you know, if you combine any of this with the pillars of the community, you get one of these more powerful people who have the ability to hide themselves and maybe have some help in covering up what they're doing and so on. So, and the last important thing here, as I say, is that despite the fact that these individuals are competitive by nature and use these mutual acts of ennui to blackmail each other, compared to what they think of people like you and me, these guys are the best of friends. That is, they will stick together, and they are bound to each other by their willing participation in the rape, torture, and murder of women and children, and they pool their resources, they call in favors, they make sure that exposure does not happen, and if that means threatening investigators and murdering witnesses and so on, it does. And you know, George Bush's name and people, kids being brought to the White House during the time he was there, and his being in Omaha also, none of that has been brought out today. I didn't have time for that, but he is very much, there's a lot of evidence against him, although, again, like with Blair and like with Brown and like with Prince Charles, whatever, you know, there's no proof, and there's not going to be. But at least we have this Jimmy Savile thing going on now that we can observe and see just how that pans out. And I thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening tonight. Please remember Robert Lloyd's program at 6 p.m. tonight. His music program is going to be on the top 10. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.